This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, from New York across the country to California, Occupy colleges with both students and faculty have been rising up.
It's an unreported story, but one of the big pushes for the Occupied Wall Street movement is and will continue to be students and faculty across the country.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael, we have an organization in New York called the New York Historical Society. It's actually interesting, the Historical Society. It was founded by WASP blue blood New Yorkers, really as a way to like document their, quote, important role in the foundation of New York and the country. It's become more expansive since then. Anybody can go to it, and it tried to do some displays on slavery the other day in New York, I mean, last year. And so it's trying to make itself more relevant. And in its attempt to make itself more relevant, I think you actually joined the New York Historical Society.
Yeah, well, I did. I was impressed with their trying to put on programs about the history of slavery in New York. Got a new director who I guess you could describe as a liberal. So I joined. I have to tell you, Michael, that I just resigned yesterday.
I wonder if you get a refund. But the big question is, why did you resign? They didn't do a good job on the anti-slavery exhibit?
I don't want a refund. I want people to understand that this organization, which purports to be a liberal organization, just honored Henry Kissinger. What's wrong with Henry Kissinger, Michael?
You mean Henry the Butcher Kissinger?
He's a real monster. The other 9/11 was when Kissinger approved of the military overthrow of the democratically elected government in Chile, Pinochet, which caused the deaths of tens of thousands, imprisonment, exiles, a horrible 18-year history in Chile. And Kissinger justified it on the grounds that no nation should be allowed to vote for a socialist.
As I recall, of course, Kissinger was also accused of actually engineering the murder of a general, I think René Schneider, who stood in the way of the coup plotters.
Yeah, because the United States had to win over the Chilean army to get rid of the democratically elected government. Schneider wouldn't go along with this. They killed him. And then, of course, they overthrew the government and probably assassinated the president.
So they honored Kissinger. And, of course, Kissinger's even, I mean, honestly, how you compare human atrocities caused by Henry Kissinger. But, of course, he was the one who approved and actually helped direct the carpet bombing of North Vietnam.
Yeah.
And it killed thousands and thousands and decimated the countryside. And that was a clear war crime. So you have two big ones, and those are the ones we know about, which is, you know, one of the engineers of the Chilean coup, and the other, of course, one of the key people involved in the carpet bombing of North Vietnam during the Vietnam War.
So sadly to say, the New York Historical Society got Henry Kissinger, but they lost me. Michael, WikiLeaks just came out with an important story on Israel.
They came out with a story, but it's really the cable. And it's an interesting cable. The cable was created on January 27th, 2010. That's about a year after Operation Cast Lead. That was the Israeli invasion and killings and bombings in Gaza. And it was released a few months ago, and it came up on WikiLeaks. And what it is, it's a summary of meetings that Assistant Secretary for Democracy and Human Rights and Labor, Michael Posner, had when he visited Israel about a year after Cast Lead, after the Goldstone Report had come out. You can get the cable if you go to WikiLeaks or look around on the net. But the cable first concludes in the beginning. It's a U.S. cable, secret cable, and it's dated in Tel Aviv, and it called AS, Assistant Secretary Posner, discusses Cast-Lead investigations with IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. And, of course, the opening reads like a list of every big general in Israel you'd ever want to hear the name of. And it concludes in the beginning, this is the American writing the summary, the charge d'affaires, Luis G. Moreno, writing the summary of Posner's meetings with the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces. And Moreno concludes, quote, "Overall, the IDF presented a convincing case that it is dealing seriously with these issues of cast lead and that the IDF exerts more energy trying to minimize civilian casualties than almost every other military in the world." you know, considering that over 1,200 civilians were killed in Operation Cast Lead, that's a pretty extraordinary statement. The charge d'affaires goes on to say, because no perfect paradigm exists for fighting a terrorist enemy that deliberately bases itself in crowded civilian areas, IDF senior commanders expressed interest in further detailed discussions with us, the United States, and perhaps other friendly countries on international humanitarian or law issues related to this problem. So there you go, a complete, like, just a whitewash of it. But then they go to what Posner actually did in the meeting. And I'll again quote, during these meetings, Assistant Secretary Posner stressed the purpose of his visit was to, quote, listen and learn from Israeli interlocutors and to confer about how the government of Israel could most effectively tell its, quote, story regarding Operation Cast Lead to the international community. So there in that one sentence, you see the role of the United States. Our closest ally, Israel, got itself in some trouble by slaughtering Palestinians in Gaza. What do? We send our Assistant Secretary for Human Rights over to meet with the Israeli Defense Forces to help them, quote, tell their story in a way that'll be more effective. In other words, our allies in a jam, we got to help them get out of this. And that's what, when you read through these cables, that's what is going on. I'll read one more sentence from it. You have to read the cable yourself, though. Assistant Secretary Posner said the United States understood the complexities of operating in a densely populated area while facing an asymmetric threat. Now, Posner does say he thinks that the way for the Israel to react is to try and do some of their own investigation and publish the findings, essentially a way of getting the UN and other organizations off the back of Israel. So there you see it on its deepest level, our Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, supposedly protecting the rights of all of us in the world, including Palestinians, really talking about protecting the reputation and standing of the US's closest ally, Israel.
To call the guy the Assistant Secretary for Human Rights, the only thing you can say about that is that he should also be given the title of Chief Ironist.
Michael, I know you've been on the road a lot, I less so, with our new book, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. And we've been getting great comments on it. We had that huge event at the Cuban Mission to the United Nations. Some 400 people came. It's an important book if you want to understand how the U.S. suppresses social movements, how it kills their leaders, how it did it back then, and how it does it today. But I know you've been talking a lot about it, and we want to encourage people to have a look at this book. But where's your next event?
I did an event last week in Woodstock, and we're doing another one December 10th in Woodstock and a December 11th in Rhinebeck up in the Hudson River Valley at Upstate Films. They're showing a movie about the CIA, former CIA director William Colby, who mysteriously disappeared, was likely murdered. And then Michael Ratner and I, Michael Smith, are going to be speaking about our new book, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. You can get it at orbooks.com. That's O-R, orbooks.com. Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. It's an important book, we think, and I don't mean to be tooting our own horn, Michael, but the book not only tells the story of who Che Guevara was, but is really a lesson in the counter-revolutionary nature of American foreign policy. They assassinated people starting in 1948, and they're still doing it. The only difference is now they brag about it. Michael, I heard you on Jesse Jackson's radio show.
Yeah, Jesse called to want to talk about Occupy Wall Street. And I said to Jesse, or Reverend Jackson, I said, you know, you shouldn't be interviewing me. I should be interviewing you, because most people probably don't know about your leadership, Dr. King's leadership initially, of course he was murdered, of the Poor People's Movement in 1967 and 68, and then a city that was put up on the National Mall or near Washington called Resurrection City. And I said, let's talk about that for a second. And so we talked about Resurrection City. And again, most of our listeners may not know about it, but if you look at some precursors for Occupied Wall Street, look back, of course, you can go back to the Bonus Army after the First World War, and they're wanting their immediate benefits paid in 1930s, and their building of a tent city. But the most recent one is the one that took place in 1968, Resurrection City. Dr. King, as we know, moved from being more strictly civil rights, into anti-war, and into understanding that the economics of this country had to be changed. I mean, he was really not a capitalist by the end. I mean, there's no issue about that. And saying, we have to change materialism, militarism, etc. And he came up with the idea for a poor people's movement. It was going to have many feeder marches into Washington, people on mules, and they did come on mules, on buses. Then King is assassinated in 68. They decide to go ahead with Resurrection City anyway. And thousands of people flood into Washington. It's multiracial, multi-ethnic. And this is what I think people have to understand. Its key demands were economic demands. Its key demands were for jobs, housing, and a guaranteed income. Think about that. Jobs, housing, guaranteed income. And they wanted to establish an economic bill of rights. So when you look at occupied Wall Street today, you have to think that this is not something completely new. There's been economic demands in this country for centuries. What we're seeing is a major flowering of it. And the example of what happened at Resurrection City is important because it was a push, as I said, for fundamental rights. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough support. They had a permit. When the permit expired, they evicted them from the grounds. Now, Jesse Jackson was 27 years old when he was there, and he stands up, and WBAI actually has in its archives the talk he gave at Resurrection City when he did a call and response, which reminded me in listening to it again of mic check. And the call in response is a poem. And it goes, I am. And the response is, somebody. And it goes on with different categories, different ethnic people. I am an African American. I am. And it's completely brilliant. And we'll link it on our website. When you think about Occupied Wall Street, think about Resurrection City.
I am. Somebody.
Somebody.
I am.
Somebody.
Somebody. I am. God's child.
God's child.
I may not have a job, but I am. Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be black, but I am. Somebody.
Somebody.
I may not have an education,
but I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
You may not respect me,
but I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be a Puerto Rican, but I am. Somebody.
Somebody.
I may be an Indian,
and
my land was stolen, but
I am.
Somebody.
Somebody.
Maybe a Spanish American,
but
I am.
Somebody.
God.
God
is my father.
Is my father.
Every man
is my brother.
I cannot allow
hatred,
malice,
racism,
militarism,
or
none of the things
separate men from God.
Keep me from knowing.
Every man.
Is my brother.
Yes.
That's what we live by in Resurrection City.
Yes.
When you meet people in the morning, all the women are high sisters.
Yes.
All the men are high brothers.
Yes.
You're defined here by the content of your character and not by your background and the color of your skin.
Michael Smith, one of our wonderful hosts, Heidi Boghossian, is not with us today, but she has been traveling around the Northeast, and she went to Dartmouth, one of the coldest, most unforgiving schools we have in the Northeast, in many ways. And Michael, you're going to read us the recent report Heidi sent us about Occupy Dartmouth.
Well, Heidi's been up at Occupy Dartmouth, and she says that while the gathering is not large in size, it's an important one, given that the college has close ties with the corporate world, such as the Tuck Business School, and a noticeable absence of socially active student body. And this, Heidi says, was according to the occupiers and was reported in last week's Valley News. And Heidi goes on to say that she interviewed a 22-year-old Dartmouth senior, Nathan Gerstoff, and Nathan said that there's been pretty regular harassment, especially at night. Nathan's been camping outside at the Collis Student Center near the Wheelock Street intersection for more than 5 weeks as part of the Occupy Dartmouth protest. And Nathan says that after 10 o'clock, people start to yell that we're idiots. They tell us to go home, and they curse and they shout slurs. Gerstoff also said that the mother of a Dartmouth student who stopped by the protest to yell at me for a while made an apparent anti-Semitic slur, telling him that he ought to get a nose job. Neither he nor the other protesters have yet filed official complaints with Dartmouth's safety and security, although they plan to do so. Drivers passing this small encampment shout epithets out of their windows, and passerbys have stolen protest signs, and they tear down the protest tent, and they left violent messages in the guest book. Heidi reports that the harassment seems to be coming mostly from Dartmouth students. When she signed their guest book, she saw one page covered with obscenities. The local community and also Hanover High School students and went where Heidi went appear to be mostly supportive.
You know, Michael, what's interesting about that report is a question I had the other day when I was on a program with Francis Fox Piven, the author of The Poor People's Movement. And someone said, what about the backlash to this? You know, we had the backlash in 68. Nixon was elected to the anti-war movement. And won't there be a backlash to this? And of course there will be. And we're going to see it both in Occupied Wall Street from the, quote, adult non-student population. But we're also going to see it at universities and colleges. Dartmouth example is one. And my daughter, Anna Ratner, who's involved, tells me about others. Her Facebook site has on it information from people who are young students just saying these people should just get jobs, they're a bunch of hippies, they're communists. And these are people she used to know at some of her background, some of them. But she writes about all the wars that are going on, about all the discrimination. But there's a core of these kids who are so ideologically blinded by what they've been taught growing up about how you make it in this country, that it depends on hard work and nothing else, and you take out elements like race and schooling and poverty, and that it's either you make it or it's your fault for not making it. And looking at the comments on Facebook and looking at comments recently, another friend of my son, Jake Ratner, acquaintance or somebody he knew, wrote something in Daily Pennsylvanian about the $1,300,000 that Amy Gutman makes as the head of University of Pennsylvania, and that workers at the college are only making $13,000. The comments, a lot of them from Wharton students, were so outrageous that you would have to give up hope in this country if you read and believed that those comments would rule the roost. So there is already starting to be a reaction, and it's amazing the ideology that's pervaded into our young people, a segment of them. My guess is, you know, at Columbia in 68, there was a thing called a majority coalition against the occupation and against all of us. Ultimately, we overran it, but of course, one member of the majority coalition was George Pataki, and he became governor of our state. I didn't. Anyway, Michael.
I guess the question is, what's the difference between the student movement in the 60s and then how it kind of evaporated and what's happening now? The three stages. The student movement of the 60s was faced with the draft and having to go to Vietnam. They weren't particularly privileged because in those days you could go to school and you wouldn't have to pay $55,000 a year. You wouldn't have to borrow a lot of money to do it. You could go to a public school like out in California and do it for pretty much for free. I went to Wisconsin where tuition was $100 a year. But that all changed in the last 30, 40 years. And I think that the students became either from really privileged backgrounds, like the kids that go to Dartmouth, who are a lot of them are just outright reactionaries, or they had to borrow money to go to school. And now there's a third stage in a movement where these students who had to borrow a lot of money realize that they're screwed, that they're not going to be able to get a job very easily, that they've got huge debts that they accumulated. I know one friend, a young friend, just graduated from Harvard Law School 3 years ago, owing $200,000. I was working with a Lawyers Guild lawyer at Zuccotti Park last week. She owes $180,000. The student movement, I think, is split now. I think they're the ones from privileged families who didn't have to borrow any money to go to school. They're the ones you were talking about, like at Wharton School.
That's true. When I read the comments, some of them were kids who just said, I worked hard for 16 hours. I didn't come from a rich family. I worked 16 hours a day or whatever I did, and I made it. And I did it by hard work. So why can't these other kids do it by hard work? That's from people who were their first generation, some of them first generation college kids.
Well,
so it's not completely a class-based thing. It's based much deeper on the ideology that's been on this country since the frontier, which is that this country is a, quote, free market. It's a capitalist market. You either make it or you don't, and it's totally on pulling yourself up. And I think that's the deep ideology in the country. I mean, there's a communal ideology also that we take care of each other and we do things, but the ones that are opposed to Occupy Wall Street, they might as well just be, you know, you might as well stamp them out from their parents or something, because they do nothing but mouth the platitudes that have made this country into an utter disaster.
We go now to speak with Anna Ratner, an activist senior at Bard College in upstate New York. Anna is Michael Ratner's daughter. She's been extremely active and will talk to us about the Occupy student movement in the Hudson Valley. Anna, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, Anna, you're a student at Bard College.
Yes, I am.
And you're part of a broad movement, of course, Occupied Wall Street movement, but you have a particular interest, of course, because you're at Bard. And is there an Occupy Bard movement?
There is an Occupy Bard movement. It started with the first cleaning, when the first cleaning was scheduled for Zuccotti Park. And people really sort of rose up together then.
That was about October 14th or so. Mm-hmm. And when you say rose up, what did they do? What kind of issues did they have?
Well, I think people sort of on their own had all been very concerned with the Occupy movement, but it was sort of around that time that everyone really found each other, and we all wanted to start organizing like weekly teach-ins and general assemblies and solidarity movements with the Occupy Wall Street protesters. And also a lot of the teachers became more interested, and we had panel discussions on the ideas behind Occupy Wall Street and where the movement was headed.
And what were some of those ideas and thoughts up at Bard?
Well, we were very concerned with, this was before it began to be cold out, so we were very concerned with what was going to happen with the Occupy movement when winter started, and also what we could do from Bard to sort of help or understand better the Occupy movement. There were two ideas that came out of it. One was that at Bard we have a lot of our own problems, such as we have a subcontractor called Aramark that is in control of all the buildings and grounds and housekeepers and workers on campus. And they treat their workers very badly. We have other problems on campus that groups are discussing. But then we also had people who just wanted to go to Occupy Wall Street and sort of move Bard to there. So we had some trouble sort of discussing where those two crossed over and what could be done at Bard and what could be done at Wall Street. And if we should just stick to like our rights as students on campus and try and occupy Bard with Bard issues and Bard problems, or if we should go to Wall Street and participate in the bigger movement that's happening globally.
Interesting. Now, what was the result of that discussion? Some were, as you said, concerned with Bard issues. And is it Aramark? Is that the name of the company?
Yeah.
Okay, Aramark, which has to do with all your...
The workers on campus.
The workers on campus. And then the question of the bigger movement down at Occupied Wall Street, et cetera. How did you guys resolve it?
Well, I think everyone was and is completely interested in both of those things. So we decided that it wasn't going to be one or the other. I think through the Occupy Wall Street movement, more kids on campus are becoming concerned with workers' rights and financial transparency and like where our money is going and how our money affects and who it affects. So I think the Occupy Wall Street movement actually helped sort of bring those topics to the surface of like the community at Bard. And then also, we constantly are having kids from Bard going to Occupy Wall Street. We had like two or three cars drive down at 5 in the morning, the night they were supposed to clean the park, full of Bard kids to stand in solidarity with the protesters. Probably had like 50 or 60 kids organized from Bard to go down on the two-month anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. And there's sort of constant back and forth. And we're also very closely linked to the Occupy Poughkeepsie movement.
Oh, tell us about that. Bard is located in Annandale, New York.
Yeah, so it's about 45 minutes away.
Tell us about the Occupy Poughkeepsie movement. I know you had a personal role in that, but tell us what's going on there.
Well, there it's much smaller than Occupy Wall Street, but it's also sort of a more local movement. They're trying to connect all the like the regions in the Hudson Valley. So they started a website called Occupy Hudson Valley, and they're focused on the technological aspect of it and sort of connecting people through technology. So they started something called Mumble, which is a program you can download.
Mumble?
Yeah. It's a program you can download to your computer or iPhone. It keeps you updated on everything, and everyone can contribute to it, and you're sort of in touch with all the movements at once. through this program.
Now, does Occupy Poughkeepsie have a space, or it's more of a...
Yeah.
They have a space.
They have a space. I'd say there's probably, like, I don't know, sorry to say, maybe like 10 to 30 constant occupiers there. They have tents and a kitchen, clothing drive. They have a lot. They're very set up.
You've been at Bard. This is your fourth year. And, you know, it's known as a very, you know, liberal school. It's artsy. But did this give you a different sense of the politics of the students at the school?
Yes, in a lot of ways. For me, it was sort of all these things I've been thinking about for... I'm a senior now, so all these things I've been thinking about for a very long time, for 3 years. But I didn't really know who to go to or, like, who to talk to about it. There were a few groups on campus that were working on workers' rights and a few, like, other issues. But until the Occupy movement, no one really came together.
No, it sounds very exciting. Can you give me a sense of what's the relationship like with students and workers at Bard?
Well, for the most part, the workers are definitely the invisible. Like, they clean your dorm, they clean the campus center, and they sort of stay out of the way. There's a group called the Student Labor Dialogue that I am not a big part of. I'm trying to be as of recent, but I didn't really understand. I guess I didn't really understand the problem until I started talking to more people, so now I'm more active in it. But they've been, for years, not just since I've been at Bard, trying to get Aramark kicked off of campus and have all the workers hired by the campus so that they can have health benefits and better wages and be able to organize. So there's that group, and that's workers and students, and they work together. But that's really the only on-campus sort of workers group that there is.
It's interesting. I had almost never heard of Aramark until you started talking about it at Bard. And then I was in Philadelphia for a march to Occupy Philadelphia. And there on the side of City Hall in one of those big light displays, you know, that you can play, you know, that you do from a projector from the sidewalk, it was something like Protest Aramark. And of course, had I not known it from you, I wouldn't have known what does that mean. But apparently it's a big, pervasive corporation that does a lot of this stuff at campuses.
Yeah. Aramark, actually, they recently got them kicked off of campus, which is a really big win.
They did at Bard?
Yeah, they did. So now the sort of question is, like, what's the next step? Because Bard wants to hire another contractor to come in. And I think Student Labor Dialogue, I know I do, but I don't think everyone's in agreement yet, wants to keep pressuring Bard to hire them as workers, like on-campus direct workers through Bard, not through another contractor.
And let me ask, when the park, you guys said you sent some cars down to Occupy Wall Street on October 14th in solidarity with the people who were going to be cleared, and then, of course, on the two-month anniversary as well. But was there a reaction to Bard of the clearing of Occupy Wall Street by the mayor of New York? What did people think?
Yeah, there's a huge reaction. We actually have general assemblies at Bard once a week, so we talk about all of that there. And then there's also the Bard Occupies Wall Street Facebook group, where it's sort of like a constant update and constant stream where people send in statuses with their iPhone, or they sort of are constantly updating it with articles and videos so that everyone's on the same page. So when the kids were down there at like 6 in the morning, we were getting updated, like live updates from them about what was happening so that everyone on campus can know. And know that, like, we do have a connection to them, and it's not something that's happening 2 hours away, but that there's kids from our school there who are representing us and who are connecting us to the movement.
I know you're in contact, probably, because you're a college student, with other campuses and other friends of yours who go to other schools. Is Bard unique, or is this happening at a number of other campuses?
It's definitely happening at a number of other campuses. I don't know as much about it there. I know Hampshire has an Occupy movement, and I know Vassar, which is right next to Occupy Poughkeepsie, sends kids over all the time, and they were holding a teach-in for Occupy Poughkeepsie protesters, where the protesters came and taught about the movement and what they're trying to accomplish. So I know that there is a lot happening. I don't know the extent of it.
How do you see the future for you and Bard and Occupy movement at Bard?
Well, I'm really hopeful. I think that the Occupy movement, for me, I know it's done a lot for everyone, but for me, it's really brought together a community of people that I didn't know existed. most of them are much younger, like freshman to junior. So I know that they're going to continue fighting because Bard campus still has a lot of issues that they really need to work out. And the Occupy movement has definitely helped bring those issues to the surface at Bard. And I think that's a really important aspect of it, is sort of bringing issues that aren't necessarily what's being talked about at Wall Street, but that are apparent in all systems across the country, including college campuses, that need to be talked about and brought to the surface and made transparent and fought for.
Anna Ratner, thank you for joining us at Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Aspect of the Occupy Wall Street movement that has been covered only sporadically or not at all is what is going on at universities and colleges, private and public, across the United States. Unknown to most is the fact that college students from all over the nation have organized nationwide acts of support with the Occupy Wall Street movement. In colleges and universities throughout the United States, there are Occupy That College, whether it's Occupy UC Davis or Occupy Bard or Occupy Vassar. All over this country, college students are in motion, much like, if not even more, than they were in the 1960s. Natalia Abrams, the full-time coordinator with a group called OccupyColleges.org, will give us an update on the overall movement. Natalia Abrams, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Now, we have a lot to talk about, but the first thing I want to ask you about is there's a website or a movement or something called OccupyColleges.org. Is that what it is?
Yes, that is our, and when I say our, it's all of the facilitators, all of the college coordinators, all of the college students. That's our website to help inform college students about the Occupy movement and ongoing Occupy Colleges actions such as walkouts, teach-ins, strikes, demonstrations, that kind of thing.
OccupyColleges.org?
Correct.
So this is where you can go to find out whether your college is involved and what they're doing, right?
Correct. And right now we're having action on November 28th in support of the events that happened at UC Davis. And we are calling for a general strike of all of the UC schools and all of the colleges that are in session to strike when they come back from Thanksgiving in support of the violence that happened to the UC Davis students.
And you're asking colleges to do what again?
To strike, to essentially walk out, not go to class, join in their central areas or at their local occupies. If they have an occupy camp at their college, fantastic, go there. And let's talk about what's happened at UC Davis. We're also circulating a pledge of nonviolence both for students and for the UC Davis president of all the, I believe, 11 schools to commit to nonviolence against students for peaceful demonstrations.
Right. The students hardly need the pledge. They've been amazing.
I guess we want to just continue to enforce nonviolence because it gets harder and harder as they continue to hurt us. But that's the point. Nonviolence is our weapon.
It puts the onus of violence on them. That scene of that cop pepper spraying those people went all over the world. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if the chancellor finds himself another job.
Can you give us a sense? You said the website is made up of facilitators and coordinators and Give us a sense of how many colleges you think are involved in an Occupy movement. What kinds of activities they're doing? Is it national? Is it private colleges more than public colleges, or vice versa? What are some of the key things people are talking about? I know up at Hunter it was, you know, ending tuition, which used to be a free school, et cetera.
I would say that there's over 250 schools that have participated in various events and that are either holding weekly meetings or getting together in some type of club. We have about 10 schools that have permanent tent occupations right now. And then a lot of the schools will participate in each of these solidarity movements. And we've noticed that it's all different types of schools. It's private schools, it's public schools, it's community colleges, state colleges, the higher university levels. We really see the whole gamut of students that are joining us. And when I say we, like, yes, I'm one of the facilitators, but I'm no more important than the college student out there joining us in solidarity movements, where it's horizontal, just like the way the regular Occupy Wall Street movement runs, and everybody can step up to be an organizer if they want to.
Now, I'm sure some of the concerns are very different at different places, but can you give us a sense of some of the concerns of the Occupied Colleges movement?
Yes, actually, I think they're pretty clear. We're fighting the rising cost of tuition, the student loan fiasco, and the fact that we have a lack of opportunities after graduation. So we go into school paying these high costs, being promised that we'll have some type of future if we go to college, and there's no opportunities left for most of us where we're getting jobs at Starbucks with our fantastic degree, and that's not why we went to school.
No, it's not very...
Not that there's anything wrong with Starbucks, but it's not why you go to a four-year education. To get higher education.
No, it's very, very clear, and sharply so. When I was standing outside of Hunter at some at there on the day of, you know, one day we had the national protests, and then I went up to Union Square where there were like 3,000 students there from the New York area and even Boston area. One
was
of their demands.
Thursday or Monday?
November 15th?
17th. Actually in New York on that day, yes.
So you were there at Union Square, I guess.
Yes.
So that was an incredible outpouring of, and a very diverse crowd. I was at Columbia in 68, and of course that was a fancy private school with a much less diverse crowd. But now colleges, particularly, you know, public colleges, but a lot of them are much more diverse. And that was amazing to be there. But Hunter, I heard the fact when I went up to Hunter, they had no tuition from 1874 to around 1975, 100 years with no tuition. So we see the shift that's going on, tuition, right, all of a sudden at public universities.
And it's more than doubled for state schools, more than, it's three times higher today than it was in 1980. We talk about the student loan fiasco, and the reason is the higher tuitions. I mean, the one leads into the other, and we first need to look at lowering tuition costs. And, you know, one of my first points of action is that these administrators need to take pay cuts, because the administrators, like the chancellors at the UC colleges, are making well over $300,000 a year with housing subsidies and car subsidies.
There's one that I just read that was sent to me. My son was at University of Pennsylvania, and they sent me the Pennsylvanian lead op-ed by, it looks like, a senior at University of Pennsylvania about the president making $1.3 million a year. That's Amy Guttman making $1.3 million, contrasting with what the workers are making, which is, you know, they're from that food company or whatever. They're making $13,000 a year.
That's 1,000 times as much.
So I guess that's your point.
We're speaking with Natalia Abrams from OccupyColleges.org. Natalia, how did you get involved in this movement?
Well, a small group of us got together at Occupy LA, and some of us had known each other from some past activist groups, and we saw that New York schools were calling for a citywide walkout on October 5th, and we noticed that there wasn't a national presence. So we called for a national walkout, and we had over 100 schools participate with almost 8,000 students walk out. And that's kind of how it was born. The interest of all of the students propelled us to continue facilitating this movement. And now we've had more students come on to help. We have student coordinators at each college. So kind of the way we work is we give ideas to schools on how to set up their occupations, and then schools take that and run with it and set up their own occupations and then kind of contact us if they need some help or guidance. But it's pretty autonomous on each of the schools.
OccupyColleges.org. It really is a thrill to see this unfolding, Natalia. What are the next steps? Where are we going from here?
We're talking about winter break, having real informative sessions and sitting down and talking about where we want to go from here. But one of our big things is to do a very large-scale teach-in in the early spring so we can really access our whole community of the college, which is not just students, it's educators and the community as well. So we want to talk with our educators that have been fighting this fight for over 40 years and see what they have to say and really start to come up with some answers of where we can go forward, especially in an election year. And then we're also talking about nonviolent activist training camps over the summer to really get people organized and motivated for what the next step is. So the summer camp will be a nonviolent training and kind of a student think tank of where we can make some changes, because we need to start looking for answers. But that will come as we have more people on board. It's kind of hard when we're talking about the issues of corporate greed and greed as a whole to come up with one specific demand when it's such a large problem.
Well, your demands have been, you know, bubbling for a long time. The ones about student loans, rising tuitions, those have been there, and that finally people are beginning to take them in hand is quite significant. Do you see more potential growth happening all the time? Is there a slowdown? What do you see going on?
I think there's an ebb and flow, but what's so beautiful is that, you know, every day somebody either opens their computer or reads the newspaper and a new person learns about this Occupy movement. So we're constantly being flooded with new energy. And that's what keeps it going. When somebody gets tired, somebody else is there to take their place in terms of a facilitation role. And there's always new schools calling us and signing up. So I personally think the energy just keeps growing. The more and more people find out about it, the more they're interested. And the more they commit actions of violence, like in UC Davis, it gets certain people on board that would never be on board. I was actually called, I won't give their name out, but by a few members of the student Tea Party who were horrified by the violence. You never would have thought that the occupiers and the Tea Party could agree on something, but the student Tea Party condemned the violence that happened at UC Davis.
Yeah, no, it was interesting. Some Republican acquaintances of another friend of mine, I don't have any Republican acquaintances, but a friend of mine said that they saw that and they said, this has got to stop. This is unacceptable.
Yeah. You know, as Gene Sharp said, the fantastic revolutionary, that their own aggression starts to be is used against them. Now so that, we're now at that point.
November 28th, that's the day of a student strike.
What we're trying to do is push a national support, and that's what we do as Occupy Colleges. We see that, you know, I feel that violence towards one of us as college students is violence towards all of us. And so it's important that we all come out and condemn the violence, not just the UC Davis or UC schools, because it could have been any one of us. And it's also happened at the CUNY schools. On Monday, there was violence there as well. So this is not just a California thing. This is a national thing.
CUNY is a City University of New York.
Yes. And so we encourage students everywhere to come out. As I said, if they're on break, on winter break, then join another school that is protesting or join your local occupation and volunteer. It's very important that we show student support and circulate. There's a pledge also for the CUNY schools. I can't pronounce it properly, the Baruch College?
Baruch, that's correct,
yes.
Baruch.
Okay, so they also had violence. They're asking for their chancellor to resign. We're asking for Chancellor Kate High to resign at UC Davis. So you can go to our website and see these petitions and please sign them. And join us for the strike on November 28th.
We will all be there for the strike. And let me ask you this. What other dates are there? I know you mentioned something in the spring, but are there any other firm dates that you have?
We don't have any firm dates at this moment. Right now, it's just the 28th, and we're constantly working in emergency action, so we can keep you updated on that. And we'll definitely keep you updated for the spring event and the summer event. But we're just trying to get more people on board so we have as many people as possible. So it's a consensus process, which takes a little while. But we really want everybody to put their voice in for what date they want to do the spring teach-in so we get as many schools as possible.
Now, you've probably never heard of Grayson Kirk, but Grayson Kirk was the head of Columbia University when I was a student there and when we were beaten on the night of whatever it was in 1968 and there was blood everywhere. And when you talk about getting rid of the chancellor at UC Davis, we got rid of Grayson Kirk at Columbia after that. This can happen, and with student strength like that and the violence of these universities, I'm very hopeful. Michael and I just love this, Natalia. We can't even tell you. As students of the 60s and 70s, this is like a moment that I feel like I've gone to heaven, essentially.
Well, that's so. What we say is that, you know, large movements have started with the help of students, and so if we don't have the students on board, especially right now when this generation is one of the largest generations since the baby boomers, we need students to really help move this movement along.
They're essential.
To quote Gene Sharp, because he's such a hero to me, when we're a nonviolent movement, the only way we can lose is by giving up. So as long as we keep standing out there and going out there and fighting.
OccupyingColleges.org. Thank you, Natalia.
Great. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
We will also have a look at the California university system. There's been a lot of protests over the years going on because of cuts in the budgets and raising of tuitions. But the Occupy Wall Street movement has really made those protests bigger and bigger and brought out the brutality of the police in suppressing those protests. To talk more about the movement in California protesting the rising tuition and making higher education less accessible, we're joined by Lillian Taze, president of the California Faculty Association, the union that represents 23,000 faculty members of the California State University System. Lillian, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you're the president of the California Faculty Association, and there's been a lot of issues going on among your 23,000 faculty. And how many students do you guys teach?
We have about 430,000 students in the California State University system.
So you have almost 500,000 students.
Yep.
And there's been a lot of issues that have been going on at that university system. And, of course, there's been more attention to it since the Occupied Wall Street issues. But can you give us some sense of what some of the struggles are for the faculty and the students in the California state system?
You know, the number one struggle that we're having, just like everybody else around the country, is the defunding, the starvation of public higher education. So that creates one set of problems, certainly in terms of the resources that we have. But piled on top of that are what we consider the misplaced priorities of the folks who are running the system. At a time when there isn't much in the way of resources available, you really have to be careful and targeted in how you use the resources you have. And so the students and the faculty and the staff who work in the university are really pretty well disgusted and fed up with the way in which the leadership seems to have a focus on their 1%, on their executives at the top and making sure that they're comfortable and their lives are working right, but everyone else really gets shoved to the side. And it's kind of, that's why there's an enormous resonance with the Occupy movement, because these are good middle class jobs that are being destroyed. And our students are looking to move into watching their parents sort of get shoved out of the middle class and hoping that education is going to be a pathway into a decent life.
And what's been the response to the huge cutbacks, which you've seen across the country? I think California, because it's so big and your university system is so large, has gotten a lot of the focus. But what's been the response? Obviously, you're a union person, but within the students?
It has created a whole new framework. I think people have finally sort of emerged from the shock of what's been happening to us and getting angrier and angrier and less tolerant, adjusting to it and putting up with it, and have really started a whole movement of fighting back. And I think that's what you see on all of the college campuses in California, where students and standing shoulder to shoulder with staff and faculty are just saying, we're not going to watch these universities be destroyed. We're not going to watch this pathway for students and for the future be destroyed. And so you have confrontations with leadership on the campuses and demands that more of the resources that are available be directed toward the core mission of the university.
Lillian, you're a professor of history at Cal State University in Los Angeles, and there's an Occupy Los Angeles that moved in right near City Hall. Have you been down there?
We sure have. We meet a couple of times a year with all of our activists, and we did a march to Occupy Los Angeles, and some of our colleagues who teach in the campuses down there have been offering free classes for the folks at Occupy. So we're deeply connected with the various Occupy movements because, of course, we're all over the state, and our faculty have been part of Occupy Oakland and Occupy everywhere. So,
you know, what's so exciting for us is to see both the student movement and the trade union movement coming together really in historic proportions.
Yes, it is absolutely exciting. I think at last seeing the common cause and emerging from the shock therapy and the shock of the 2008 upending of our economy to really realize that we've got to take back more power and authority over our own destinies.
Now, I know here in New York, at least with some of the student protests in particular, we're getting the loan issue is a big one for students. Wanting to abolish any kind of tuition is a big one. Wanting to change the Board of Trustees is a big one. How did those sort of dovetail, if at all, with some of the issues that you and the students are raising in California?
It's actually exactly those same kinds of issues. Student loans are crushing our students. The leadership of the CSU and the UC seems to think that an answer to their problems is privatizing the university by shifting economic responsibility over to students, faculty, and staff. And so they're using us like ATM machines. When the state isn't providing resources, they come to us to either give up salary and or pay more for school, and the students end up deeply, deeply in debt, and that is not good for the future.
You know, that's very profound what you just said, because you said the word privatizing the universities by essentially using students, faculty, et cetera, as ATM machines. Yes. And so what you're saying is, yeah, it's ostensibly it has a sign over its door that says public university, but in fact, the public resources aren't what's being used to fund those universities. It's taking it out of the pockets of faculty and students, which is essentially making it private.
Yes, and it certainly speaks to our experience, and I think one of the reasons why faculty, students, and staff and union members are coming together, because we're all being exploited, and we're all, you know, being asked to be unwilling donors to the university. I mean, you know, we took furloughs as faculty. We voluntarily took furloughs in order to save faculty jobs and save classes for students. We made an investment as a result of about $150 million in the system. People lost their jobs anyway, and classes were cut anyway. And so I think we've all come to the point where we see the direction they're taking this and regard the university as a public good. And I think it needs public support, and our leadership really needs to be fighting for that and not picking our pockets.
You know, I can imagine, because I see it up here at some of our colleges, with as the faculty gets more and more involved in these activities that you're describing, and then the students get more involved, there's efforts to punish the faculty, and it's done in different ways. If you're not tenured, and I don't know what your system is there, they come down on you. They've come down here on some faculty that were leafleting or running teach-ins. Are you getting that kind of harassment as faculty? What are there, 23 different campuses
right
in the system where your union people teach?
It's playing out at the bargaining table. What we're finding is, in order, I think, as a way to silence this and attempt to control the way in which we are fighting back, what's happening at the bargaining table is that the management of the university is trying to take back all kinds of job security, trying to take back their salary offer is nothing now unless later. So they really are working at the level of our union contract to try and discipline us, and I think try and make us stop doing the fight back. But I think they have picked the wrong fight.
So give us some sense of how you see the future. How do you see the future the next 6 months, the next year? I mean, where do you see your own struggle to really change some of these terrible aspects about the current educational repression or system, and where do you see the movement going?
Well, I'm more optimistic than I have been in a long time. A year ago, I wouldn't have imagined that we would be having the conversation that we're having now. But Occupy Wall Street has really opened up a door to a conversation that is so long overdue, and I think those of us who are engaging in that conversation are not going to give up on it. So 6 months from now, a year from now, I think the pressure is going to continue to build. More and more people are going to understand and see the common cause they have with this whole movement. So I am more optimistic today than I have been in a long, long time.
Lillian, you couldn't have made us happier, I'll tell you.
Well, good.
We've been speaking to Lillian Tez from the California Faculty Association. Lillian, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. We look forward to speaking with you again.
Yeah, we're very excited. I mean, your words are really terrific words of optimism.
Great. Well, stay in touch.
Good.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org and look for us on Facebook at Law and Disorder.
Law and Disorder has a wide geographical coverage in the United States. We have many, many affiliates. Today, we want to thank those affiliates. If you broadcast Law & Disorder and don't hear your name as an affiliate, please let us know. If you don't broadcast it, or you have a station that doesn't broadcast it, get them to and help us spread the word of Law & Disorder.
WHYS in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee.
KSOW, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP, Clay, West Virginia. KRFC, Fort Collins, Colorado.
WRCT, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. KWMD, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJ, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF, Enid, Oklahoma. 1640 AM, Front Royal, Virginia. WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina.
ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago, Oakland, Atlanta, Boston, Melbourne. Moton Community House Radio, online. WLRI, Gap, Pennsylvania.
WPRR, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS, Columbus Community Radio, Central Ohio. KKFI, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, California. WSLR, Sarasota, Florida. KDX, Internet Radio.
Lorain Community College Radio, Cleveland, Ohio. WHUS, Storrs, Connecticut. WJFF, Radio Catskill.
WDRT, Viroqua, Wisconsin. WERU, Bangor, Maine. KMUD, Oregon. Garberville, Eureka, Laytonville, Shelter Cove.
Voice of Sacramento, Sacramento Community Radio, Sacramento, California. WWPM, MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois.
Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR, Provincetown. And I'd like to send a special shout out to Provincetown since I grew up there every summer. WMHC, Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Mass. I'd also like to shout out to Mount Holyoke because I did three semesters there.
That's a record for Heidi.
Shut up.
KSER, Everett, Washington. WHUS, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington.
WCRS, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU, Illinois Central College in Peoria, Illinois.
WGCX, Community Radio, Green and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, Southbridge, Massachusetts. Thank you all. Thank you.